Good afternoon. My name is Jonna, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the OMMIG follow-up call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star and the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Peggy Chan. You may begin your conference.
Yes. Hi, everyone. Thanks, Jonna. As Jonna said, this is our second call with my colleagues from the Office of the Medicaid Inspector General. We had previously distributed, I believe, some links to documents that are our references. And, you know, after our first operator-assisted call, I think people found it useful, but more questions to follow. And so we're here to review those. So here today with us is Stephanie Coley, who is the head of the monitoring unit and the Bureau of Compliance at the Office of the Medicaid Inspector General, and Matt Babcock, who is the Assistant Medicaid Inspector General and, of the Bureau of Compliance. So thank you again for joining us today, and I'll turn it over to Stephanie and Matt.
Great. Thanks, Peggy. Stephanie's going to have some comments, but I just wanted to set the stage. It's, you know, we appreciate this opportunity to come and talk to the health department and the performing providers and the performing provider leads on this very important topic and the compliance obligations. And again, our goal here is to try to address today some of the questions. And again, there really isn't a formal presentation like there was back in February. And we would look to try to utilize this mechanism as a way for us to respond maybe directly to some questions some people had. Peggy made reference to a couple of resources, and since the last call and some discussions with the health department and some inquiries that we've received at the Office of Medicaid Inspector General directly, we put together two different items that I think were referenced. One is Compliance Guidance 2015-02, which OMMIG published on its website in the Compliance Library section of the Compliance tab, and that went up on March 30th. And the second document is a DSRIP Compliance Guidance 2015-01, which was published yesterday. And I think that what we'll do is Stephanie has some points that she probably will lead off with, and then to try to address some of the one or two common questions that we've had. And then at that point, probably Peggy, if it's all right, we just open it up to questions and use the balance of the time to try to respond to specific questions people might have.
That's good. Thank you.
Okay, great. Stephanie.
As Matt mentioned, the two documents that were recently published were in response to our last open call in an attempt to address many of the questions that had come in following that call, either as part of that call or following that call. One of the couple of points that I'd like to highlight before we get into questions is some points that were made in the recent publications. I think what we've heard from several of the PPS leads was that there's an assumption that they have to take on responsibility for the compliance programs of the performing providers within their networks. And, you know, we would just like to start by saying that that is not the case. That's not the expectation. The PPS lead is expected to have its own compliance program. We recognize that it may interact with existing compliance programs of providers, you know, within their network. But it's not the PPS lead's responsibility to take on others' compliance programs. The PPS lead's responsibility is really to, as it states in our last publication, follow the money. The legislative intent behind the mandatory compliance program obligations was to protect Medicaid funds by developing systems that allow providers to self-detect and prevent fraud, waste, and abuse from occurring. And so with the lead PPS compliance programs, we would expect them to apply those systems to the DSRIP flow of funds. So that being said, we'll open this up to any questions that anyone has in general or specific to the recent publications.
If you'd like to ask a question, please press star and the number one on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from Dan Rinaldi with Alliance for Better. I'm not sure what that is. Your line is open.
Hello?
I'm sorry, I was on mute. This is Dan Rinaldi from Alliance for Better Health in Schenectady in Albany. Just a quick question. In terms of, you know, the full-time aspect of a compliance officer, you know, many of us are just starting these corporations. For example, you know, we had our first full board meeting a week or two ago. You know, there are no funds presently being distributed into the corporation. And, you know, I'm an accountant. It seems not realistic to go out and hire a full-time compliance officer that has to be on the payroll at this point. And, you know, I know from reading the literature and being on the website and so forth, that seems to be the case. And again, just a question, is in fact all of us have to have a full-time compliance officer, you know, which could cost us, you know, most of them are lawyers or accountants with certifications and so forth. I mean, is that really what you're looking for initially from the gate?
Well, let me break your question into two pieces. Is your compliance officer required to be full-time? No. Do you have to have an employee? Yes. The point, I think, in recognition here is unlike some, the directive is under the federal sentencing guidelines, which kind of exist outside, obviously, of New York, unless you're convicted of a federal crime. New York specifically requires your compliance officer to be an employee. The law also recognizes that the compliance officer may have other duties, may have other responsibilities, which may not require him or her to be in a full-time capacity. Generally, what we would look to is that we clearly look for an employee, and the test that we generally look to is the person, a W-2 employee. We're not talking about leased employees or you know, anything other than a true employment relationship in an objective kind of determination. And then the second thing we look to is whether it's full-time or part-time, look to see if the compliance obligations are being adequately carried out. And those are, and part of that is reporting to your governing board. Part of that is reporting to the CEO of the entity that's required to have the compliance program. So, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, the way the legislature and our regulations mirror the legislation require an employment status of the person who is, quote, vested with responsibility for the day-to-day operation of the compliance program, end quote. So that's really one of the things we are trying to address in Compliance Guidance 2015-02. But the employment status is really something that we can't really change from at this point based upon the current law and regulations. But they don't need to be full-time. And there could be some other recognition of involvement with, you know, another compliance program within the network and some kind of joint employment relationship between that other, maybe a performing provider in the network and the PPS lead. But there has to be an employment relationship with the PPS lead who has got to have a compliance program.
Let me follow that up for a moment. If in fact, and you know, in our PPS, we have a bunch of hospitals, is it possible, and many of us, you know, have pretty extensive compliance programs, audit programs, and so forth, is it permissible that, say, compliance officer at one of the hospitals could be a part-time employee of the PPS and supply those services?
It's certainly possible. I mean, I think what I would suggest you do is take a look at the compliance guidance 2015-02. if the relationship between the hospital, and we'll use that in your example, if the relationship between the hospital and the PPS lead is that the hospital is corporately part of the PPS lead, okay, and think of it in the terms of either wholly owned or in this case, because they're now doing a nonprofit.
And the example I'm using, it would be the hospital would be one of, you know, eight members or something like that. Let's just say.
Right. But if you've got four hospitals that are all, for lack of a better phrase, co-owners of the PPS lead, you don't have, there's going to be, we don't have that, what I call in the guidance, a unity of ownership and control. So in that particular situation, if you had four separate hospitals and a PPS lead, and the four separate hospitals are all owners or principals in that, the compliance officer in Hospital A is going to have to have an employment status with the PPS lead. Okay, part-time is fine. If by chance you had a Hospital A and the PPS lead are, you know, not co-owned, I mean, the PPS lead is not, is a direct line relationship ownership interest with no other dilution, then at that point we've taken the position that the compliance officer down in Hospital A could come up and do it up in the PPS lead. And that would be an example of what is outlined in the guidance under the holding company example. We also talk about wholly owned holding company example. What we also talk about in the guidance, which where you would require separate employment relationship, is when you have a non-wholly owned, which is the example I gave a moment ago, four different hospitals, each owning or being a joint venture partner with the PPS lead.
Another component that came up in this question had to do with the credentials. And I believe the gentleman said lawyers or auditors, and that is not a requirement.
No, right, Peggy. There isn't, the statute doesn't establish a set of mandatory criteria. I think that we generally look to, whether it's in this environment or just in general, we look to what the provider that has the compliance obligation feels is appropriate for those, for what they have to do. You know, so lawyers is fine. I mean, could be fine, could not be. I mean, you could have a great compliance officer that is something other than a lawyer, accountant, or some other kind of professional.
But just to clarify, that wasn't
right.
That is
no.
Necessary
criticism. No, I understand. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Your next question comes from Laura Alfredo with Greater New York Hospital Association. Your line is open.
Hi. Good afternoon. I want to start by thanking those of you hosting this call for all the work that you've obviously put into trying to formulate guidance for this community as they try to put together their compliance programs and, you know, do it in a way that makes sense. During the last call, there was a suggestion that some more formal guidance might be coming out, possibly even based off of what was done with the health home projects. I'm just wondering if that is in the works, or, you know, if you're thinking of satisfying, you know, providing the guidance through these sort of open calls. Hello?
Yeah, Laura, this is Matt Babcock. We're not at OMIG. I mean, we will continue to try to put together some guidance, and as we've done with this DSRIP compliance guidance 2015-01, we've developed a separate corner of our website to try to address specific questions. And I think that is, I think, how we're generally going to try to address it on the short term. As we get closer to identifying a timing for doing compliance program reviews of PPS leads, and we talked a little bit about that, I think, at the last call, we will most likely be trying to push out even more guidance and direction on that. The issue of the home health, I'm not sure that was part of our last call. I don't recall. Your memory might be better. It's probably much better than mine, but I don't really recall that statement here. But we will be putting together, trying to put together guidance and direction, and some of what was put into the DSRIP compliance guidance came from, as Stephanie mentioned, context. We've had discussions that we've had with Peggy and others at the health department. So, but if you're expecting to have a comprehensive document that goes through it, we don't have a deadline, we don't have a projected date, and I'm not sure that we're in a position to take that on right now. Not to say that we won't ever, but just not something I think we're looking at right at the moment.
Okay. Well, as I said, I think that what you have done has made a huge amount of headway toward satisfying a lot of the questions that we've been hearing here at Greater New York. What I would say, though, is that there's still a lot of questioning around how to identify risk areas, how to do a risk assessment, and whether that needs to be focused on the leads areas of exposure as leads versus the exposure for the enterprise itself. And so, I'm not sure that you can address those areas right now, but I just want to make a point that those are I think the very detailed areas where the leads are really, scratching their heads and trying to think of the best ways to formulate their programs. So that's sort of where we see the greatest need, I think.
I mean, Laura, I would say that I think that Stephanie's initial guidance at the start of this call is really a great place to start. It is that, rather than it is the follow the money. It is where, how are incentive payments once received, what governs their distribution based on what grounds, that all of that follow a specific path and an audit trail. And I think that's really, what this is. I don't think it needs to be much more exotic than that. I'm getting nods from both Matt and Stephanie. So
yes, that is the, I think, foundation, of every plan. But as far as specific risks, being a little bit more granular, if you read the April 6th publication of special considerations for PPS leads, that walks through the regulation by element, and within the commentary under special consideration by element, there are particular risks that PPS leads should take into consideration. And we also point out in that document where the PPS lead will want to coordinate with the providers in their network, and maybe tie into their compliance programs. So hopefully that document is enough to point out certain risks, as a start.
Thank you.
Yes. And I think the one point to close and to kind of build on what Stephanie was saying is that, and Peggy said, is that when you're talking about following the money, the money that's going out today has got a certain character and purpose. And as this process extends into year 2, 3, 4, there is additional commitments, requirements, and purposes for that money. And those are commitments being made by the PPS and their networks to the health department. And I think that as you're sitting and assessing risk and where you are, today the money's coming for this reason and these goals and purposes, a year from now, it may be something else. So, there's some stirring of the pot that you need, you constantly need to be assessing where the money's going, what the criteria for getting the money is, and what your performance levels are relative to getting the money at the level that you're getting it for. So But I think that's kind of how it is. And again, one of the reasons we don't try to be obtuse at at Omeg on risks, but you know, for us, everybody's network and everybody's structure creates a unique set of risks. Everybody's commitment to the health department is a little bit different, and that creates different risks. So I think that, again, following the general guidance and the special considerations guidance that we have should be the takeoff point for some thought process for you to try to customize what you have in front of you to make sure that you feel comfortable that you are doing your best to identify opportunities for fraud, waste, or abuse, or people make mistakes and correcting it, and all the things that we have jurisdiction at Omeg about. But again, as we mentioned, I think the last call is that the analysis of are those commitments being that have been made to the health department, are they being met, is ultimately the health department's determination. And so it's primarily looking at the roadmap you've provided to DOH, and are you living up to it, and are your partners within the PPS, within the network, living up to their commitments to you. So with that little supplement to Stephanie and Peggy, I don't want to be left out.
Okay, so can we move on to the next question?
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from Heather Sanchez with Fort Drum Regional Organization. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. My question is in relation to Element 6 of the 2015-1 guide. It indicates that the PPS lead system should include a plan for auditing and monitoring how network partners are utilizing the district funds. That goes against the funds flow, the guidance that was provided by the Department of Health. Basically, what we have been told from the beginning is it is about accomplishing the objectives of the district, and that partners can use the funds for what they need to use the funds for, regardless, as long as they accomplish the objectives of the district. So, can you explain that?
I'm looking at, I heard what you said, and the PPS lead system should include a plan for auditing and monitoring how network partners are utilizing district funds. And, you know, it is that what your distribution to your partners is based on an agreement, and ultimately that agreement is about how that achieves district goals. So I think that's really the framework for this. Do you have the basis for that payment?
That's about the accomplishing of the objective. They don't get the payment unless they've accomplished the objective. What they do with those funds after they receive them, I mean, this is saying we have to monitor what they do with those funds after they receive them. And that has never been guidance that we've been provided.
Well, I don't know that it says it. You need to monitor the funds. You need to consider where the funds are going.
But it does say that. It says a plan for auditing and monitoring how network partners are utilizing district funds. It says it very specifically.
Okay, that may have been more clear. With considering whether or not goals are being met, and what you'll want to consider is if you're distributing funds and the goals are not being met, then why is that? And
so
then it might lead you to question. What's that?
So will that be revisited, because that is not what that says?
Yeah, we can look at that language and to make sure that it's consistent. If you're saying based on your subcontracts or agreements about the role of
your
network partner, you asked them to perform a certain role, and did they meet that objective, or are you funding that role? And then there are I think those are the things that just to make sure all those agreements and everything ties back. I think that's the real
thing. So it's making sure they meet their objectives, not how they are utilizing the funds internally.
No, if the agreement is that, you know, to earn the district payment within your project, they are to be, you know, doing this particular piece and or that they are to reach this goal, and that's the basis of the payment, that's really what we're looking for.
Right. So for accomplishing the goal, but not how they're utilizing the funds.
Right. But what you might want to look, at that if you determine that funds are flowing and there's a particular provider that's not meeting their goals, now you might want to look into how those funds were being utilized as part of a risk analysis for, why, how come you're not meeting those goals if we gave you the funds in order to accomplish that? So it might be something to take into consideration if issues were to arise.
But that's part of their risk assessment.
Right.
And then whatever necessary actions they would need to accomplish or put into place or take.
Right, right.
Okay.
Peggy, is there some situations where a PPS lead may be pre-funding some activity? So to the extent that there's a pre-funding of activity, anticipation of certain goals being met at some point down the road, I mean, that would be another example of where you're going to be looking. You know, if I gave you $100,000 with the idea that you're going to deliver five things to me.
Right, so there's a whole category. There's a whole piece around flow of funds. So there are five particular categories. One of those is project implementation costs. And so that, you know, in terms of especially ramp up, you know, there'll be, okay, in order to do this, to begin to meet this district project goal, you know, we're going to need to put in, you know, have like, you know, hire three staff.
Right.
We're going to need that those implementation costs covered. So we are going to contract with, you know, such and such agency and provide that seed money. So it does definitely goes on that. But, you know, again, that's, again, part of that construct of what they would have in place internally. Meantime, they have subscribed to us. We're not getting a report that says they're necessarily, you know, we're, you know, hiring the three staff, but we're looking, they're just giving us this flow of funds saying implementation costs, you know, all these other things.
Right.
Yeah. It says how we're going to accomplish, but not, because as long as that sentence is changed, because according to that sentence, it looks like the PPS lead is becoming a grant maker who has to monitor every dollar that's spent out for them utilizing those district funds, and that is not my understanding of the intent.
Sure. Well, we'll go back and take a look at this language. And again, I think what we've talked about here is really ultimately, you know, what it comes down to is it's all about performance and meeting those requirements and making sure that when the state's investing in that performance that it is actually occurring,
you know,
is really what it comes down to. So.
Yeah. So.
But thank you for that clarification or fine point on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next caller.
Your next question comes from Tracy Miller with Bond, Schoenecke and King. Your line is open.
Thank you. My question is, what is the meaning of PPS lead? And that term had a particular meaning in the early planning stages, and those were the organizations that submitted the district applications and underwent a financial feasibility test and undertook other activities. But at this point, many of those organizations have joined with other partner organizations to form a new corporation for the purpose of receiving district funds and operating the PPS. So are those new corporations now the PPS leads in the way that you're using the term?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
So the new corporations have taken on full responsibility as the PPS lead in all obligations and commitments made in the original PPS application.
Okay, thank you.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from Andrew Ryan with Lethbridge Medical Center. Your line is open.
Hi, it's actually, I punched in the middle of the last conversation, and I just want to point out the sentence on guidance 2015-01, the sentence that bridges page 1 and page 2 also talks about funds distributed as part of this program are not connected with fraud, waste, and abuse. If you could look at that as well with the general eye that under certain programs, things might be considered fraud, waste, and abuse, but for example, the pot of money that is incentive payments, I think as Peggy said before, on incentive payments, it's really not about where the money goes, it's what they've done to earn. So there might be an adjustment that is needed there, which was the first thing that kind of flagged the same concern of the caller two callers ago that I raised, because it was tracking money and assuming it was used in more of a traditional manner. But please just take a look at that and see if there's a modification. I don't have one suggesting, but it's kind of implying that we need a program for all the monies that are used in a standard way, which is not necessarily the district structure.
Well, yes, and I think that we'll certainly take a look at that as well. But I think, you know, one of the things that, as Stephanie and I were talking about this as we were putting this together, is in the situation where the 2015 initial dollars going out is not for delivery of service, it's at this point as we understand it, but it's for the, what I'll call re-engineering the delivery system. You know, it's a little bit different focus than what we historically have looked at as far as the Medicaid program, where you're delivering a service and getting paid, whether it be a fee-for-service or capitation or whatever. But still, there's some opportunities for people to commit fraud or, you know, for there to be fraud in the sense that if in a hypothetical situation where you have a network provider who is misrepresenting to their lead that certain milestones have been met, and, you know, there may be some fraud based upon reporting or some representations, which, you know, clearly creates a Medicaid fraud issue because these are Medicaid funds get received inappropriately. So I think that, you know, one of the things that we're looking at is it's a different kind of fraud can still exist in this whole process. It's just, it may be a different type of fraud. It may look different, but still it's based upon or can be based upon misrepresentations of what has been done or what commitments have been made, you know, and things like that. So we will certainly look at the guidance again following this call and look at that particular clause again. But, you know, we acknowledge that fraud in, as we are today in the DSERP program is a little bit different than what everyone has historically known and come to be familiar with as fraud in the Medicaid program.
Yeah, and your point is very well taken, and we're fully aware that both we have responsibility and that there are many things that can exist that shouldn't exist in this program. But I appreciate you looking in, and whether it's putting a finer point on those distinctions or, you know, acknowledging them more explicitly, that would be great.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Again, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad if you would like to ask a question. There are no further questions at this time. I'll turn the call back over to the presenters.
I'm hoping that if there are questions, people aren't shy. but I thank the previous callers for the questions that came up. Okay, we've got two more. Okay, next caller.
Okay, Regina McGraw with Bond, Shenick and King. Your line is open.
Hi. This is really a follow-up call, and it's really for Peggy. This has to do with the changing of the who the lead is. I know that, you know, OMIG's guidance seems to, in the situation where a PPS has organized as a new co, seems to be referring to that new corporate entity as the lead. And all of us that have been in DSRIP world for the last year think that the lead is the applicant, whoever applied, filed the December application, was vetted by the Department of Health. From the Department of Health standpoint, in this NUCO situation, are we now saying that the original applicant is no longer the lead? And if so, do they have any ongoing responsibilities?
There were 10 new corporations that went through CMS approval. So I guess I'm not clear as to, you know, unless they have been approved, and they were approved as part of that whole application process. There aren't any other, I mean, other organizations, other PPS leads who choose to become a new corporation will all have to undergo the same, review and approval process by us, and then we forward it on to CMS. So I guess I'm a little unclear as to your question.
All right. So of the 10 that you referenced where there's been a approved new corporation formed, from your perspective, from the Department of Health's perspective, who's the lead of the PPS? OMIG is saying the lead is the new corporation now. Is that what the Department of Health is going to start, who they will refer to as the lead?
Yes, because those new corporations came through us and approved by CMS to be the leads. And so once that was approved, those will be the leads. Those are the leads. And those will be the same entities. And we've been going through a name exercise to make sure we've got everybody's legal, all the legal entities' names correctly. Those will be the ones that are awarded the award letter.
Will the department issue any guidance to the original lead applicants as to whether they have any ongoing accountability back to the department for the 5 years of DSRIP?
If the PPS lead is a new corporation, that is the PPS lead. I guess I'm not clear as to, perhaps you and I should take this offline so we can discuss the particular situation.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from Heather Sanchez with Fort Drum Planning Organization. Your line is open.
So in element 7, it says the PPS lead system must include a method for prompt corrective action and refunding of overpayment. Does that imply that it is the PPS lead's responsibility to refund overpayments to the department if indeed a partner does misrepresent and misuse the funds? Is it going to fall on the PPS lead to ensure to pay back that overpayment?
Well, I'll turn it over to Peggy to give the DOH view. I guess where we come from and where our direction on this on the element 7 is that, again, following the money, if the flow of the money is from the state to the PPS lead, and let's say for the sake of discussion, the PPS lead in good faith was relying on a misrepresentation made by a network provider, which the PPS lead as part of its risk analysis identifies a problem and says, hey, you know, you need to give me some money back because, you know, I relied on your misrepresentation. I incentivized an excessive payment, you know, a payment more than I should have received. The money's got to come back. I think that the relationship, the primary relationship, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, Peggy, is between the PPS lead and the network provider in this program. So, you know, the PPS lead has got the commitment relationship with DOH. The PPS lead's compliance program, as part of that, has to be identifying under element 7 correction. Just the general overall requirements of element 7 require the one with the compliance program to identify an overpayment, make a recovery, and take steps to prevent the recurrence. So to some extent, I defer to DOH on how they would look at this, but I would look at, in the context of a PPS lead's compliance program, that the PPS lead is going to have some accountability to making sure that that correction has occurred. Now, whether that network provider makes the payment back to the state in whatever format is determined, or whether it comes back to the PPS lead, the PPS lead makes a refund. I mean, but again, that point about recovery of an overpayment, recovering of an incorrect payment, is embedded in the standard requirements of a compliance program under social services law. So I'm not sure exactly. Go ahead.
So, in fact, the PPS lead is going to be responsible for refunding overpayments if any PPS partner defaults and makes, let's say, let's say they made payments to a hospital provider that is IAF funded, is, you know, and they don't go through and they don't make it, or they have challenges, or something happens and they cannot comply, and they've been given these funds to do that. The PPS lead is going to be responsible for giving that funding back that they can't recover from the partner.
You know, that's an interesting situation. I mean, I would, I'm not sure I'm ready to, you know, commit to that, an answer on that, Heather. That, I think, is, you know, that's such a complicated process. I think, you know, obviously the language here, as Matt said, you know, really does come from a kind of a traditional Medicaid approach. I think in the case of this, we'd have to look at the specific circumstances. But the idea is that if you, you know, if we kind of go back to, again, if for some reason, you know, we set the, you know, you are given DSRIP funds, and again, it's more your internal process. If you find that you have a non-performing provider, but meantime you've paid out funds to them for accomplishing something, what is your process? I think that is, you know, I think that's kind of really the direction that we would be look, what direction we'd be looking for.
So
right.
That perhaps that could be changed to say that the PPS lead system will include a process to work with the provider to have corrective actions and do refunding of overpayments to the department or something. So that it does not appear here that it's expectation that the lead will pay it back.
The one thing to keep in mind, this guidance document was drafted using the language that is in the statute and the regulation as the foundation of the guidance. So, you know, certain language that you're referencing is based in our regulation and cannot be changed. And it needs to be considered as part of the compliance program. It might not be applicable in all phases of the DSRIP program, or you know, it might change as the DSRIP program develops. When you talk about refunding overpayments, you also want to consider, were the payments made based on fraud, waste, or abuse of those DSRIP funds? Or was the non-performance a result of, you know, some other reason that was in good faith, an attempt to reach those performance goals? I mean, that's going to be the difference in, you know, whether or not the money needs to be refunded. And also, you know, you want to consider the system that you have in place to prevent further funds from being, you know, from flowing that might result in non-performance. So you want that system of corrective action that the compliance program is designed to encompass.
Yeah, having a system for that, a corrective action, having a plan, having a process is absolutely, of course, need to do that. It's just, I just think we need clarification on expectation of refunding overpayments for that by the lead rather than, you know, them being responsible for that. Somehow can we, you know, tease that out in a better way to make sure that folks clearly understand if they are indeed going to be responsible to pay back when, if network partners do not, you know, misrepresent.
Right. And again, I think you have to look at, as Stephanie indicated, you have to look at these this compliance guidance, DSRIP compliance guidance 2015-01 in the context of the statute and the reg. And the statute and the reg require there to be a system in place for identifying and reporting compliance issues to DOH or OMIG. And it also requires a system to be in place for refunding Medicaid overpayments. Now, the point that, to build off what Stephanie was saying, if payments are all made in good faith, no, you know, no fraud, waste, or abuse, and you find that something happened, you know, I think that I would expect that the PPS lead would be having a dialogue with the health department.
Well, yeah, and I think there's two levels here. One is when we talk about an overpayment, you know, there's what the PPS itself is paid for, that's really done through the initial, you know, maximum valuation of the project application plan. So there's this maximum amount that the PPS can get if that assumes that they reach every single milestone and fulfill every single project requirement. And then that is monitored and that is evaluated and then that is determined and issued by the independent assessor. So there is that piece. I think this kind of gets into, so there's that level of, is there something that happened in that project plan valuation, in that network somehow that led to something that the maximum value is not what it should have been? That would, I think, seem to speak more to the overpayment aspect. But when we talk about the PPS lead internally within its own network, I think that is really, you know, I would, you know, again, and we share this as a discussion point, is that where they have subcontracted for a specific set of services or for implementation costs to get something going, and they find that, you know, their subcontractor in that role did not fulfill, you know, then what is their process? I think we're talking about two different realms here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, this, what it comes down to is a requirement is a system
mm-hmm.
to do it. It doesn't say how much. It doesn't say exactly how to deal with it. But I would expect that whatever your system is for disclosure and for the recovery, to be honest, that it's going to involve a substantial amount of discussion with the health department and working through the details of what that would be. And again, we can't sit here today and say, well, if these five situations happen, this is the result. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's going to pretty much be as the health department sees the facts and circumstances. If we were to do a compliance program review, we're coming in and saying, do you have a system to be identifying the problems, making recoveries to the extent that it's worked out? I mean, we look at it at a very high level. Peggy and her staff are looking at it at a much more granular level if and when that happens. So, I mean, I think that the point here is that you need to have these in place, be thinking about those things to be prepared if that event happens. If you don't figure that that's going to happen, I don't think you properly identified the risk. Many times identification of a risk is you're identifying something that has some certitude, some level of certitude that it may happen. It doesn't mean that it's going to,
mm-hmm.
but
right.
You want to have something in place, though, that if it does happen, you're prepared to take the appropriate steps to address it.
And I think every system will do that, and certainly this system will as well. There
Great.
Could just be clarity that it will fall on the PPS lead to bring back funds if they're misused by a network partner who misrepresents. That would be helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Michael Gatto with Nassau University. Your line is open.
Mike?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm wondering, in terms of establishing contractual agreements across hubs within a PPS, for example, the safety net facility, contracting with other facilities across the various hubs of a PPS for, like, the administration of a PAM, and, say, placing time and attention on a facility administering the PAM and then establishing a contract for remuneration for whatever that would be worth. Are there specific guidelines within contracting with the other facilities that we should be following for these types of projects, for example, Project 11, in terms of compliance and inter-facility contracting?
We have not really thought about. We have not put out there anything that is that I think speaks to the question you have. From a compliance standpoint, I think it's, again, you know, a clear business agreement.
Right.
About what you expect them to do and all the specific business terms and what would happen if there is that those terms are not fulfilled.
Right. Again, I think the first thing is having a contractual, some obligation between the network and the lead, and the contract is one of the easiest places, at least from our perspective, to work that out, where performance is laid out, expectations for what happens if performance doesn't happen, and I think from a compliance perspective specifically, you'd look to for the, you wouldn't want the PPS lead to say, I think there's something bad going on over here, and then have the, what's going on over there, they basically say, you can't come in and look at me.
Right.
I mean, you know, so, I mean, I think you'd need to make sure you've got those kinds of controls with quotation marks around controls or structures, you know, in place, so you can hang off of it all the things that need to be performed, clear obligations and consequences for people who aren't meeting it, you know, and whatever it is. So if those unexpected things happen, then there's no surprise to anybody that's in the relationship.
Very good. Okay.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from George Clifford with Albany Medical Center. Your line is open.
Hi. I need to go back to the overpayment issue. This is very concerning to us. From the initial letter of intent and all through the planning process, we were repeatedly assured that, in fact, payments to the PPS lead would be based on domain one metrics and milestones, and in future quarters, milestone and metric reporting based on deliverables that were unique to each project. So if we're able to do that and receive payment, we've been led to believe that, in fact, within some constraints in terms of what percentages could go to non-safety net providers, among other things, that in fact we would have some latitude to be innovative and creative in terms of transforming the healthcare system. When you refer back to statute and regulation that in fact isn't innovative or creative or allows us the flexibility and talk about overpayment, you're making me very nervous, because what we promised our organization and our PPS was that this would really be based on our ability to meet milestones. Now, we may have members of our PPS who get funded who, in fact, suffer penalties, don't meet contractual expectations, et cetera. And there may be situations where we still meet our speed and scale measures and are able to receive full payment, but in fact may end up having to get overpaid by someone who didn't perform what they were supposed to do. But that's a big stretch to then argue that we've got to return money to the health department in that circumstance, because maybe that's what the statute and regulation says. But I think you've got a disconnect here between OMIG's view of the statutes and regulations and what DSRIP is trying to do. So please understand, this is a very concerning issue for us.
All right, so George, I think what we'll do is we're going to work through, you know, what are the scenarios where the overpayment scenario actually applies. And my, you know, just again, for me, it's, you know, number one, how the application was presented. And then really what drives this is also the network, right? That's what really settled on what that larger contract amount was. I think the kind of thing that to me would be the most applicable here would be if for some reason there was a whole provider group that, you know, drove valuation that had been included. And in fact, you know, and I think we kind of prevented this from happening now because of the OMIG attestation audit that you know, there wasn't any false valuation that happened because of the inclusion of ineligible providers or by providers who said that they did not, in fact, agree to be in the PPS network. So I think those are the situations that really are correspond to the kind of overpayment scenario that is suggested here in element seven.
And I think it's also important to keep in mind that, you know, when you think of overpayments, you should think of it in terms of, you know, fraud, waste, or abuse of funds, and not in terms of innovative uses of funds. So, you know, you really need to consider, you know, the use of the funds.
Did you get the funds through, did the health department make an award of funds based upon a misrepresentation? I mean, if I think what I've heard you say, George, is if, for example, the system, the PPS system met all the performance requirements within it, qualifying for money, but there was one or two network providers that were underperforming, but it still didn't affect that. I mean, is that an overpayment? No, I don't think that that's an overpayment. But if there's a misrepresentation that you hit certain targets, which incentivize the health department to make a payment, which they wouldn't have made if they knew the truth, that would be, that's a fraud representation, which creates an overpayment. So we tend to think at OMIG about an overpayment being in cases of fraudulent fraud, waste, or abuse. And what Peggy was talking about relative to network validation and ineligible providers in networks. I mean, those are two things that kind of driven by CMS and by program just in general. But again, as money starts to go out and certain milestones have to be hit or payments are made on the condition that certain milestones have to be hit, if there's a misrepresentation to the health department that
right, so
things are happening, that's a fraud, and that creates an overpayment.
Right. If there is a two quarterly reports and the PPS has submitted that they have, you know, met this and therefore has achieved an achievement value for that, and a payment goes out, and the independent assessor actually will be doing auditing.
Assessor's role is that they have a very critical function in terms of making sure that that misrepresentation doesn't occur in the first place.
And, you know, so again, it all ties in there. So that's, I think, part of the process we're talking about.
Right. It's not our intent. And this isn't
to stifle innovation.
No, exactly. That's the point I was going to try to get to.
It is to make sure that, you know, in fact, what has been, obviously OMIG is looking at it from a specific lens, and this is where they're saying, well, then it's DOH also monitoring performance. So the DOH side of monitoring performance is, again, through the independent assessor. But, you know, the worlds do meet, at least in terms of, you know, this idea would be around if there has been some, something that was provided that, in fact, wasn't true. Then, you know, what is the process? What happens? I think we've hit the hour as well.
Yes.
And there are no more questions in the queue.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, I hope this was helpful. Maybe we didn't all agree, but we'll look to clarify where we can. Okay. And again, appreciate the questions and the scenarios that were brought up.
Thank you. Thank you again, Peggy. On behalf of OMIG, we want to thank the health department and everyone that's been on the call. I mean, this is certainly helpful for us to make sure that we're focusing on issues that help improve the process, improve innovation, and be supportive of the health department's program. So
okay.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. All right. Thanks, everyone.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.